Folks, thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to our members on the Zoom call and others who will listen later in various other places and manners. So it's great to have Ben and Ben Tullabloo back at the Sydney Institute. He was here, we're trying to remember, and we recall it was late 2019 before COVID-19 commenced, and a few months, 5 or 6 months before that. So he's well known to some of our members. He's a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies in Washington, D.C. He writes regularly in various newspapers and journals such as The Atlantic and The Wall Street Journal and other places where you can and we do read him. But tonight, our speaker's going to talk on the topic of Iran in 2022. Many thanks.
Thank you very much for that kind introduction, and to everyone at the Sydney Institute for making this possible, as well as friends at AJAC for helping host again. It's a pleasure to see you all in person, especially coming out actually in person amid the tail end, hopefully, of the COVID-19 pandemic. And to the Zoom audience, well, we still get to thank you anyway. last time I had the audacity in the pre-pandemic era to wear an ascot, so I thought the fashion statement I would show off today would be the braces. So if I'm invited again 2 years from now, who knows what item I should don, maybe a bow tie or a cummerbund or something, but we can cross that bridge when we get there. To a slightly darker, less fun note, Iran in 2022. It may not be at the tip of your minds, or unless you focus on things like the nuclear deal or terrorism or non-proliferation or ballistic missiles or a lot of other fun topics. But I want to dig a little bit deeper about what's been going on in that country, particularly since we last spoke, and how that affects everybody. In 2019, when I arrived in Sydney, it was September, and I think it was just a day or so after that historic strike by Iran at Saudi oil facilities, probably the most important oil facilities in the world in eastern Saudi Arabia, where they took off quite a bit of that country's oil export output for quite a while, using drones and cruise missiles launched from their territory or Iraqi territory. It's still somewhat debated, but many do believe it was launched directly from Iranian territory. Months after that, about 2.5 months after that, you had probably the most widespread, largest ever mass protests against the government of the Islamic Republic in the entire history of the Islamic Republic. And that's the theme I want to take you towards today, which is the cleavage in Iran that exists between state and society, because you'll likely hear more about the security threat. You'll likely hear more about the nuclear issue. You'll likely hear more about the Iran-Saudi, the Iran-Israel, the Iran-US tension. But what I will venture to guess that you may not hear a lot of is that state versus society divide inside the country and where it's going, and even how among the elites, the acceptable boundaries for speech and political orientation will also continue to shrink, making that regime even more hardline. And like the old saying goes, if you don't bend, you break, kind of taking that regime ultimately in this direction after it's been around for about 4 decades. So those protests that happened in 2019 were part of a newer trend of protests. Protests are not new in Iran. Protests against the Islamic Republic have been happening almost as long as there's been an Islamic Republic. So while there was a very broad and diverse coalition of groups that in 1979 ousted the U.S.-supported Shah or ousted the U.S.-supported king of that country and ultimately made the regime that we now know to be the Islamic Republic that in that same year, in 1979. That was a wide group, included various kind of leftists, communists, Marxists, Islamist communists, Islamist nationalists, and a few others. And in the 4 decades since, the regime has used inter-elite competition, factional disputes, but also, perhaps most importantly, a whole series of foreign policy disputes to narrow that political spectrum. So what birthed the regime through a very wide coalition or coalescence of voices ended up becoming an ultra narrow, ultra hardline kind of cohesive set of voices. And every decade you've seen figures rise and fall to prominence. You've seen many Western reporters, Western analysts, Western governments even realize that the president in Iran is actually not the ultimate arbiter of foreign and security policy, that the president is actually not even the most important political, economic, military, or religious official, that title goes to someone whose title is meant to be taken quite literally, that is the supreme leader of the country. There have been about 8 or 9 presidents, I think, in the Islamic Republic's history, but there's been about 2 supreme leaders, and still, bless you, still with the second one. He's 83 or 84, if I'm not mistaken. And now that elite that he had inherited, the regime that he had inherited, he's now thinking about legacy. And in the way that he's been thinking about legacy, you've seen them pursue an even more aggressive foreign and security policy, but there's also been more of this contraction that we've been talking about. And the best way you can understand this contraction is to kind of draw a sharp contrast. So in 2013, there were a lot of Western reporters, Western analysts looking at the allegedly, quote unquote, moderate government of Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani. He was, quote, elected and inaugurated that year, spring, summer of that year. And many were talking about the number of Western PhDs in his cabinet. I think it was quite a large number of Western PhDs in his cabinet, not just American, but Western. You can contrast that with the government of the current president, Ebrahim Raisi. He's also someone who ran for president in 2017 and lost and ran again. He has no organic political following. Many people say that he would be next in line to replace the current supreme leader, so potentially he could be the country's third supreme leader. This individual kind of distinguished himself through the letting of blood in the 1980s. He's held multiple positions in Iran's judiciary, so he has no organic political following. And ultimately, he's been failing upwards through carrying out the Islamic Republic's edicts on the home front, literally signing off on death warrants. There were several fatwas in the late 1980s at the tail end of the Iran-Iraq War that was basically used to clear out Iran's prison system of political opponents. And under a very perverse litmus test, basically upwards of 5,000 political prisoners were killed. And he was one of the 4 judges who had been signing off on these things. And this person was about 29 years old when he was signing off on them. There's audio recordings of them. There's audio recordings of the success, the, one of the potential successors to the founding father, if you will, of the Islamic Republic, actually protesting and reprimanding these judges for what the crime they were about to commit to sign off on these certificates. He eventually fell out of favor and he eventually went into house arrest. But Ebrahim Raisi continued to fail upwards. He became chief of the judiciary, if I'm not mistaken, in 2019. He was sanctioned by the US, and that brings us to the point of comparison. Whereas in 2013, you had quite a large number of Western PhDs in the Iranian president's cabinet. Now, in the cabinet of Ebrahim Raisi, you have about 40%. So just under half of that country's cabinet is subject to some kind a foreign political economic penalty, some kind of sanctions. And I'm not just talking about US, I'm talking about EU, UK, UN, and even Interpol. So it's a qualitatively different kind of cabinet. And how does that relate to the political housekeeping and that narrowing boundary of political space, and again to the protests in 2019? It's essentially to tell you that that aggressive foreign policy you see is also reflected towards an even heavier hand at home. And that's the point I'd like to instill in you guys today, have you guys take away with, that there's this increasing comfortability with the use of force, there's this increasing comfortability with the foreign aggression, domestic repression paradigm. And what the regime is doing is continuing to use all of these different disputes abroad, at home, inter-elite, interfactional, to narrow that spectrum, to make it ultra-hardline, to make it more cohesive, and to make these things happen with greater regularity. And so when there is some kind of exogenous shock to the system, like protests in 2019, in November 2019, protests again in mid to late January 2020 to February 2020, after the downing of that Ukrainian airliner that killed over 170 passengers, all innocent civilians, then even protests throughout the COVID process, the way the regime dealt with COVID. I'll try not to discuss COVID, get everybody talking about that issue again. But that also was a political issue inside the Islamic Republic, rejecting of some foreign aid, rejection of some vaccines. There was even drama, not just with the US, but even with the Koreans more recently, who were offering face masks. That's, again, a source of tension in the regime. But ultimately, moving into that series of protests, I mentioned that there was a series of protests inside Iran as long as there's been an Islamic Republic. But into that November 2019 period, it's called the Aban protests or the November protests, there was a economic trigger for those protests. And that led many in the outside world to say, well, it was just protests over high gas prices, because gas prices had been surging. There had been some subsidy cut issues in November 2019. And it led many Western reporters, Western analysts, even Western government people to see the initial mass uprisings, which kind of did not begin in the capital, contrary to protests that you saw in 1999 that were sparked by a political trigger, the closing of a reformist newspaper, or 2009, again, beginning in Tehran, the response to a botched election. These began outside the capital. Think of it as an outside-in kind of nationwide protest that changes demographics, that changes geography. It's a shifting pattern in Iranian protests. Rather than beginning with more Western-leaning youth in the capital and then spreading out, this actually begins with the urban and rural poor, with the generations of people that the revolution was allegedly supposed to have been for, the downtrodden and the dispossessed, or in the political parlance of the Islamic Republic, the mustazafin, the oppressed. This was supposed to carry out the next generation of the revolution. And ultimately, these are the folks who are more aggressively protesting against the Islamic Republic. So contrary to that 1999-2009 paradigm, where a political trigger begets a protest starting in the capital, 2017 to present, with the onset of much foreign pressure, particularly from the US, you actually get again this domestic nationalist kind of protest, that outside in urban, rural, poor that we had talked about. But 2017, at the tail end, in response to an economic price shock over the cost of eggs, 2018, throughout the first 6 to 7 months of that year, sustained into the summer, many, many different kinds of strikes, many different kind of nationwide protests. Again, same dynamics, urban and rural poor, downtrodden and dispossessed. It continued into 2019, 2018 to 2019, there was some flooding again in Iran. Any kind of trigger, environmental, social, but particularly economic. And this was basically the Iranian people showing in the lead up to that November 2019 protest that they would use any available medium to signal their dissatisfaction with the current governing elite. And willingness to use non-political issues, the environment, for instance, willingness to use the regime's downing of the civilian Ukrainian aircraft in the mid-January of 2020, the one that the regime shot down in the same time that it had launched ballistic missiles against those two bases in Iraq after the killing of Soleimani, who was Iran's chief terrorist mastermind that the U.S. had killed with a drone strike on January 3rd, 2020. The Iranian people were using even foreign policy issues to discuss and publicly signal that there was a very different kind of view and value system that they held that the governing elite inside that country did not hold. And you can see this represented in their slogans, for instance, starting in 2018, 2019, in that same evolving pattern of nationalist protest. There's a slogan said about Iran's involvement in Syria, for instance, that begins to reprimand the regime for the blood and treasure and even national reputation spent defending a genocidal regime like the Bashar al-Assad regime, which also had gassed its own people, which was particularly stark in the minds of the Iranian population who had suffered chemical attacks several decades earlier during the Iran-Iraq war. So ultimately, one of these slogans was, "Forget Syria, think about us." Or in Persian, it was, "Suriyaru rahakon fekri bahalamakon." So it had that nice rhyme at the end of it as well. You can even trace some of it to 2009, for instance. One of the most famous ones was about Iran's support for Palestinian terror groups and some of the proxy organizations the regime has in the Levant. One of those slogans was, "Not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life for Iran." And that had been a slogan repeated through multiple iterations of protest. And both of these two slogans were chanted for about 6 or 7 days in 2019 in November, when a surge in gas prices right at the middle to tail end of that month had triggered that same exact convalescence of forces. Nationalist protesters against an Islamist regime, a post-revolutionary society coming out to protest a revolutionary government, and so on and so forth. All those other factors of dissonance that we had talked about. And looking at these variables, there is one that you have to also add in, which is violence. the level of the state violence from in against these nationalist protests into present was something that was relatively undocumented before and relatively unseen before. For instance, there was a Reuters assessment at the end of 2019 that had three sources in Iran come up with this figure, that there was 1,500 people killed in the 6.5-7 day protests. And they were killed during those protests in November when there was a nationwide internet blackout. And this is something pretty salient to take note of, because it's an evolving state or repressive kind of apparatus response to this shifting pattern of protest, where many of you may know this paper of record in Washington, in the States, back where I live, the Washington Post, they have this line, which is like a tagline, democracy dies in the darkness. And most unfortunately, it's not just democracy that dies in the darkness, it's the Iranian people that died in the darkness, when they couldn't coordinate their messages internally, when they couldn't get videos of what they were doing out abroad. It became, again, a way for the regime to use that massive anvil, that massive hammer, use that surge in violence against protesters in a very overt and kind of grotesque way, without wanting to be seen as having to pay the cost for it. So no media coverage, greater repression. And this is an evolving thing that we see in newer patterns of protests, and something that we saw with the protests that began this May. So this May, that new ultra-hardline president who is about to come up on his one-year anniversary this month, Ibrahim Raisi, that person who I told you was failing upwards in his career, his supporters had talked about earlier in the spring needing to perform something that they had labeled economic surgery, which in the proximate, very short-term period, they were saying was tied to the impact of the Ukraine war on the Iranian economy, whether you consider it to be over wheat supplies or vegetable oil shortages, or even shifting patterns of global trade that come on the back end of pandemic-induced supply chain shocks for that country. There had already been the Iranian economy that was in a pretty weak position. And then, of course, the lingering or continuing effects of sanctions, which were still there but were diminishing, because the Biden administration in Washington retained many of the penalties that it had inherited but was not actively enforcing them, because it was seeking this resurrection of that 2015 nuclear deal that the Obama administration, along with international partners, had agreed to with Iran. The Trump administration had left, and the Biden administration was trying to resurrect it. So it had that lingering economic effect, pandemic effect, plus, of course, the mismanagement at home. And then the regime had this food subsidy issue. And in response, the regime had actually drastically cut some of these subsidies in response to this kind of intoxicating brew of economic issues that particularly had caused massive supply shocks and massive inflation, plus, of course, in the short to medium term, very significant price hikes in essential staples, what had become newfound staples, to even include enriched grain products like pasta, well beyond traditional staples that included rice and flour, but even to things like pasta in the average Iranian diet today. And that had triggered several days of mass protests in Iran, beginning with the same newer geographic and demographic pattern, beginning in Iran's southwest, where there's two large different ethnic minorities. There's the Bakhtiaris and, of course, the Arabs. And then the protests spread out from the country's southwest throughout most of the nation. You even had some protests in Tehran. But again, the capital not being the focal point is this major new kind of critical thing to take away in this shifting pattern of protest. So you've had a revolutionary regime, an Islamist government ruling over a nationalist and basically post-revolutionary society, and the Iranian population trying to signal with every successive crisis that comes their way, and with admittedly very immense bravery, that the regime doesn't speak for them, that the value system is not their value system, that the foreign policy is not what a more national or Iran first, if you will, to borrow from the political parlance in Washington now. It's not what that foreign policy would essentially look like. And it all matters because it means that in this period of elite contraction, when you have the government willing to coarsen, willing to narrow, and even kind of move the system further and further to the right, in the kind of the parlance of the country's supreme leader, they talk about this thing called the train of the revolution, or the, in Persian, it's the Qatar Inqilab. It is, imagine a train leaving a station and essentially shedding cars as the train continues to go along the track. And that means that everyone who was part of that wide coalition that helped get the train into the system, get the train on the rail, doesn't stay there for the duration of the journey, doesn't deserve to stay there because they're insufficiently hardline, they haven't proved their revolutionary credentials through a certain kind of action, or through a certain kind of deed, or through a certain kind of domestic political parlance. And ultimately, the train loses cars and the train speeds up towards its destination. And what we're watching now with Iran in 2022 is this increased speeding up towards that comfortability with foreign overt aggression and overt domestic repression. And that overt thing is what I'm talking about, because the lipstick has kind of come off. The regime used to have to try to feign moderation, used to have to put Western PhDs, people who spoke great English, at the helm just to be able to elicit some kind of foreign concessions. Now it's a fundamentally different equation. They believe that they can have their cake and eat it too, advocate aggressively on behalf of their revolutionary values, continue to try to live and manage violently and mitigate violently this dissonance between state and society, something that a lot of other neighboring countries about a decade ago showed you during the Arab Spring was basically an untenuous proposition, that ultimately this was something that was not stable. But the regime feels like ultimately the one ingredient to keep everything together is going to be force. So there's this increased willingness to use this kind of force. So moving into the tail end of 2022, I would suspect that the next crisis is going to try to predetermine what the next crisis is going to be. It's going to be like trying to find a needle in a haystack. You simply have to be ready, whether you're a human rights advocate, whether you're a journalist, whether you're a lay citizen, whether you're a policymaker, whether you're someone who's simply interested in this country, whether you have family there, whether you're from there, whether you have friends who are from there, is to know how relatively volatile that situation is. I know sometimes Iran may actually draw a stark contrast, but that really just shows you, when it draws a stark contrast with some of its neighbors, how unfortunate the situation, for instance, the situation of its eastern neighbor Afghanistan is, that you have, you know, again, more Afghan refugees and more migrants from some of those areas into Iran. On the western flank, for instance, you had some migrants, refugees after the 2003 Iraq War. But it's a very tenuous situation, but it's one that the regime feels increasingly comfortable in. And it's that kind of hubris, that kind of elite hubris, you could say, that comfortability with using violence to manage and mitigate that tension, which is actually ultimately going to beget the next round of protests and ultimately going to beget that next cycle of violence from the state against the society. So I don't come with you with great news today. Iran in 2022, the picture is not good. There are different macroeconomic indicators that we can talk about. For instance, there's things that the regime is doing to generate revenue illicitly, at least illicitly in the face of the existing sanctions that remain, that the US Treasury continues to try to selectively enforce, at least since this May. It's been trying to enforce some oil sanctions, some petrochemical sanctions. You know, petrochemical sales are through the roof, but no one in that society is actually feeling the impact of that. There is an increase in regional trade, for instance, between Iran and some of its neighbors. But when you look at society, no one is actively, again, feeling the trickle-down effect of that. And this combination of the regime being able to generate some kind of funds, but the people not being able to experience or feel the effect of where those funds are generated from, with or without sanctions in place, will ultimately mean that those funds will go to the things that at the foreign policy level, or the overt kind of public security policy level abroad, means that we're going to be seeing more of the activity that has kind of made and sustained this regime as the world's foremost state sponsor of terrorism. So, you know, there was a time when we laughed when Iran thought it would, when Iran had downed a U.S. drone, maybe more than a decade ago, with a, or either some people said the drone, this surveillance drone, the RQ-170, it's an American surveillance drone, had been downed or had crashed in Iran, I think about 10 or 12 years ago. And people were talking about the changing patterns of Iran's drone employment, and would Iran ever be able to develop such drones? Now you're reading in the press that allegedly Iran is going to be transferring drones to Russia to further underwrite Russia's kind of irredentist and imperial actions in Ukraine. This is for those of you who do follow the Iran-Russia relationship or are familiar with one of the ways the Russians actually generate revenue abroad. The Russians generate a lot of revenue through arms sales. They have many clients who do purchase arms. And in the post-Cold War era, in the three decades since the end of the Cold War, the arms trade between Russia and Iran has been entirely one way. It's been Russia selling and Iran buying. And this changing kind of evolution in Iranian capability, where they actually do have this robust drone power now, means that the pattern could go entirely in the opposite way. And it raises the question, again, this is more of a foreign and security policy than an Iran in 2020, but we can unpack some of those threat vectors, changes in the nuclear program. Why is the regime saying no to a U.S. deal so far? What's going on the missile front? What's going on the Israel-Saudi-U.S. front? But ultimately, this is a change. And I think there will be more of these changes, because that is where that money is being invested in the missile program, which continues to be the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the region, in the drone program, which even the Russians are now allegedly interested in continuing to impede maritime shipping, and continuing to have this threat network that the regime itself calls the axis of resistance, or in Persian it's called the Mehvar Muqawamat. And these are proxy groups, partner groups, terror groups that they either created in some of these jurisdictions where they don't have state-to-state contacts, or they co-opted militants on a battlefield, but with the ultimate goal of controlling these groups and then using these groups they control to contest the relationship with the state and reorient the foreign and security policy of that state. So again, this is where the illicitly generated revenues are going. It's not going to help get people around a potentially new wave of an Omicron variant. It's not going to help people offset some of the subsidy issues that have been triggered by some of these massive price spikes. It's not going to, for instance, redo some of the infrastructure in some of these places that are protesting on literally the geographic and social periphery of the country so that those individuals can have a better life. It's just a fundamentally dissonant worldview of what is in their priority. And I think it's pretty clear that that which is in the regime interest is not at all which is in the public good or in the national interest. And that is likely going to continue to be a driver of more protests. So while we may not be able to identify what those specific protest areas are, I think it's pretty clear that to continue to signal their political dissatisfaction, any economic grievance, any social grievance, any environmental grievance, any foreign policy grievance may well be the next trigger for another kind of mass uprising, which, all else equal, given the constellation of hardened men at the helm today of power in Iran, are more inclined to use violence to remain in power than ever before. And on that rather unfortunate note, I think I will pause and we can turn it over to questions.
Well, many thanks for your substantial but rather pessimistic analysis, but it's important to be realistic. Can I just ask you about, I mean, you didn't use the word theocracy, but I guess you'd describe Iran as a theocracy with a supreme leader who's become a narrow Islamist, fundamentalist. But to what extent is the degree of religion matter here? I mean, is this an issue between the Shia in Iran and the Sunnis in the other area? Or do we overplay the division between, I mean, there's a rivalry between, as you pointed out, between Iran and Saudi Arabia, but is that religious motivated or other reasons or a bit of each?
Thank you.
It's yours.
You can take it if you want. You ask a very important question. It's one that if you look at, for instance, the Saudi-Iran rivalry with your phone, like a video, it looks different over time. But if you take just like a snapshot of it, it may look more sectarian, as you had mentioned, depending on the time. For instance, the regime, ever since it came around in 1979, has had this foreign and security policy principle. It's called the export of the revolution. And those partner and proxy groups that we had mentioned, that's one vector of the export of the revolution. You create a group, you co-opt a group, you control a group with the ultimate purpose of contesting a state that is not aligned with that foreign and security policy vision. So, for instance, the regime is Khomeinist, it's Islamist. There was an eight-year war with its neighbor, which was secular, Ba'athist, pan-Arab nationalist. So it was a conflicting ideologies, even before we get to sectarianism. But the regime actually had created different groups. Dawah, the Dawah Party in Iraq, for instance. Another group, the Badr group, the Badr Corps. This was, you know, Iran's first armed proxy in Iraq right after the 1979 revolution. So it uses these groups, political groups, militant groups, terror groups, religious organizations, charity organizations, to kind of further that message. In the case of Saudi Arabia, for instance, yes, obviously there is that sectarian difference. There's even a quote from Khomeini I had found near the tail end of his life. Khomeini's the founding father that we had discussed of the Islamic Republic, where he talks about, you know, if, and I'm paraphrasing the quote, but the quote is out there, we can find it. I think I wrote it in a 2014 or 2015 article about Iran's tensions with some of the Arab states of the Persian Gulf. And ultimately, he's saying that even if Iran gets over some of the other foreign policy issues, I think he says even if, you know, Iran overlooks America, if Iran overlooks Saddam, it will never forgive the Al Saud. So there is that very strong, strident ideological tension between these two states. But then you can zoom out a little bit. Pre-revolutionary, there's the geopolitical competition for oil markets. At that time, prior to the revolution, also there was competition for who would be the greater pillar. At that time, it was obviously very clear that it was going to be the Iranians would be the greater pillar of the Western-led order, or the kind of pillar of stability of the region. The Saudis were the economic, the Iranians were the military and economic kind of pillars in what had many called the Nixon administration's twin pillar policy in the Persian Gulf. And that all changed with the 1979 revolution, but there are some geopolitical or structural differences in the tension as well. But when you look at this export of the revolution in the aftermath of the revolution, so from 1979 to present, you see an ecumenical approach rather than a sectarian approach at times. So to get over some of the things that could automatically put Iran in the minority box, so majority Persian in a area that is majority non-Persian, you have majority Arab, you have majority Shia country in an area of the Muslim world which is majority Sunni. So one way that the regime had actually gone around some of these ethnic and sectarian religious minority status issues that it had after 1979 was to simply not use them and to frame its competition in non-sectarian ways. So Saddam, for instance, during the eight-year war with Iraq, Iran didn't frame it as a war Sunni versus Shia. Iran framed it as a war between truth and falsehood. Mm-hmm. Who is the better Muslim in that sense? And, you know, you've seen this rivalry change, for instance, with the rise of an Islamist party in Turkey, with the AKP, you know, led by Erdogan. And now next year is a very historic year for those of you who follow Turkish politics, because 2023 is going to be the centennial of the Turkish Republic. And imagine what a sharper contrast the Turkish people would have. In 1923, you have kind of the father of modern Turkey, the father of Turkish secularism, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, Atatürk literally father of the Turks. And then a century later, you have Recep Tayyip Erdogan, you know, Islamist political activist, jailed, turned politician, turned prime minister, turned autocrat, turned president, who may be in a similar position to someone like Putin, where he may have to occupy that position for life for his own kind of domestic, legal, political issues. I'm not a Turkey expert, but you see that very sharp ideological contrast in the turn Turkey has taken in the latter portion of this timeline here. But these two non-Arab but Muslim states, which also have a history of rivalry and competition with one another, they vie for leadership of the Muslim world through the competition of who is the greater champion of the Palestinian cause, for instance. That's one vector for their competition. And then this is transposed to, you know, where are their views aligned or misaligned on Syria and elsewhere. But with the Saudis, they've borne the brunt of this, and everyone who is in that axis, the vast majority of these actors that are in this axis of resistance are Shia, which is that same sectarian group that the Islamic Republic is, but not everyone. So for instance, Sunni Hamas, is in the axis of resistance. The Houthis, who are in Yemen, the Yemeni rebels who have been fighting since 2015, they're literally doing things like using child soldiers, absconding with humanitarian aid, launching missiles at population centers, and yet the U.S. recently removed them from the terrorist organization list in 2021. It's a political issue, don't get me started. But they are not even the same kind of Shia as the Islamic Republic. The Islamic Republic is the main, has it claims to be home to the mantle of mainstream Shiism. So the majority of Shiites in the world are Twelver Shiites. The Shiites in Yemen, they're Zaydis, or what they're also called Fiver Shiites. So it's within a sect, they even have sectarian differences. But the Islamic Republic is trying to paint over these sectarian differences with its Khomeinist interpretation. So when you look at Iranian soft power outreach, or the Islamic Republic's soft power outreach in places beyond the Middle East, you could look at sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria, for instance. You could look at South Asia, Pakistan, for instance. You could look at South America, Argentina, for instance. It uses a different diaspora group. You know, the Lebanese diaspora in South America is quite large, but it uses an ecumenical approach to even try to get native recruits, converts. And in that sense, it doesn't play the sectarian card. It tries to, if it's going to try to recruit someone or anyone really, the most fundamental thing that it's looking for, the point of entry, is not shared ethnicity, it's not shared faith, it's not shared sect of that faith. The kind of least common denominator and the point of entry is political orientation. Meaning, does this person, does this individual harbor an anti-status quo, an anti-Western political orientation? That is the point of entry. From there, it gets easier and easier if you have these commonalities, co-religion, co-sectarian, co-ethnic. But those are not sufficient conditions. There is only one sufficient condition, which is the political orientation. These are things that enhance the ties, but that entry point is exactly why the regime has in many ways a much more global apparatus than may meet the eye. And it has a much more unique kind of competition with Saudi Arabia beyond the Middle East. You know, there is a great book or a report waiting to be written by an Iran analyst and a Saudi analyst that draws on the language of competition between the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the Cold War, which at that time many analysts called it the missile gap, meaning the gap between the number of missiles the U.S. has and the number of missiles the Soviet Union has. I think if you look at the two different kinds of Islamic and Islamist outreach of these two regimes over time in the past four decades, you could write a great book or a great report looking at the non-Arab world and call it the minaret gap.
Before we go on, I should say, thanks to the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council for bringing our speaker to Australia and making it possible for him to return to the Sydney Institute. A welcome return. Question, we've got some questions here. We'll go here first. Okay. Yeah.
I want to sort of bring in a two-pronged Ukrainian kind of focus. Putin went to Iran in recent times, and I'd like you to comment on what you think that was for. But David Harris from the American Jewish Committee was here a week ago, thanks to AJAC, and he was commenting on the US-Iran sort of Obama nuclear deal that we think might come back since Trump's gone. But he spoke that of Iran being suspicious now because Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons only for Russia to invade, and that they see that as the result of having done a deal that had no consequences of good for Ukraine. So they see that could happen to them in any kind of deal on nuclear weapons. So could you pop those two things together and comment on Iran and the nuclear deal and Putin?
Sure. Thank you very much. There is much more than meets the eye in this new axis. And axis is, again, the kind of a word du jour here. We have the axis of resistance. But you have this new kind of axis of states rather than that axis of resistance, which was the non-state actors that the regime created or co-opted. There is this kind of broader foreign policy network the Islamic Republic has cultivated. And it's very interesting because allegedly they say it's on a placard outside the foreign ministry, but it was also an informal slogan at the tail end of the revolution. And that slogan was, neither East nor West Islamic Republic, which was supposed to tell you about the value system. It meant neither capitalist nor communist. They're allegedly trying to do their own thing. But what you've seen with this kind of eastward shift for the past two decades now, an overt eastward shift, you can look at it in terms of markets, you can look at it in terms of military to military ties. There are increased Russia-China-Iran naval drills. There's like two or three already in the past few years. And that is, those ties are set to continue. You have greater business ties, with or without sanctions. China, for instance, has been the largest and perhaps most important importer of Iranian oil products. In the pre-sanctions era, during sanctions era, post-sanctions era, in the pre-deal era, during deal era, post-deal era. So much of the Iranian foreign and security policy that Australians don't like, the UK doesn't like, most of the Commonwealth countries don't like, the US doesn't like, is underwritten by these enhanced ties economically and militarily with China. But on the Russia front, it's the political cover and the Islamic Republic's increased willingness to play junior partner to Moscow. And this is kind of plays into the, you know, Russian grand designs. But ultimately, for a regime that had made so much noise in its revolutionary heyday about sovereignty, it's been increasingly willing to give it up to states which will instrumentally use the Islamic Republic as a pawn in their strategic competition against the West, and particularly against America, and particularly against American-led international institutions like NATO. So you see this in the evolving Iranian rhetoric on the causes and consequences of the Ukraine war since late February. It's kind of become an echo chamber in many ways for some of the same causes and consequences that Putin likes to put forward, theories for the Russian invasion. But ultimately, to begin to tie it to the nuclear deal, in March, it was one of the first major stalling points of the Iran-related nuclear talks this year, and there have been many. But the talks are currently still stalled, but the first major stall happened in early March, just about 2 weeks after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And this stall followed about a month and a half of messaging from everywhere in Washington, but including the media. Everyone believed that the deal was right around the corner in 2022. This weekend, I know too many people, reporters, think tankers, analysts, government people who worked weekends tirelessly because they thought that on that Monday or on that Saturday or on that Sunday, the new Iran deal was coming and you got to get ready and do your homework and get up to speed and see who's been saying what and translate and follow the press and everything. The deal did not come. But that first major stalling point was in the aftermath of the Ukraine war beginning in late February, the Russians sought a clarification that the business that they would be able to conduct with Iran, because the nuclear deal does permit government-to-government ties between the Russians and the Iranians from their civil nuclear sectors, but also because the Islamic Republic has a very largely sanctioned banking sector, and it took many years for those sanctions to be built. Some were unilateral, some were multilateral. But the Russians, in record time, got the world's attention through its activities in Ukraine and got a very similar swath of sanctions put against it. So the Russians wanting to make sure that any kind of economic ties they would have with Iran, because A, they have potential military-military ties, B, there is the nuclear-to-nuclear ties, the commercial, civil-nuclear-commercial ties, something that the deal would bring forward rather than scale back. And see, the Islamic Republic has many decades of experience of working around multilateral, unilateral, bilateral, majority Western-led sanctions, whereas the Russian Federation doesn't. And that's actually a skill set that the Islamic Republic has, and it's probably something that the Russians are very eager to learn about, how to use the international banking system to continue to do things that you don't, to continue to do things that you want to do for your foreign policy, that continue to bring the ire of the international community upon you. It's how the Islamic Republic has been able to survive the Trump-era maximum pressure sanctions, as well as its own mismanagement, as well as the lingering effects of some of those sanctions. So ultimately, I think that troika of forces, the willingness to bust sanctions, the willingness to grow commercial nuclear ties, and the willingness to grow military ties, is what got the Russians to pause the nuclear deal talks in March. And you can go back and look the first week of March, many thought the Russians had torpedoed the talks. And people were trying to read something into Iranian President Raisi's visit to Moscow that spring. and then ultimately try to come up with something about fraying Russo-Iranian ties, when in reality the Russians were simply looking for a sanctions carve-out. And unfortunately, it appears that they got it, but there still is no deal. And as to the lessons of that Iranian mistrust, I understand the logic and I agree with the logic, but I don't believe that that is the motivator for the Iranians. In short, one of the main reasons, there's four main reasons why the Iranians still have not said yes to a deal that, if you look at it in terms of macroeconomic reasons, would benefit them, and also in terms of nuclear reasons would benefit them, because it wouldn't actually prohibit them from developing a bomb. It would in many ways give them what many call a patient pathway to a bomb. The nuclear deal that was agreed to in 2015 is basically a large timeout. It's not a solution to the problem. It's an attempt to manage the threat. In my view, it's a poor attempt to manage the threat. In the view of others, it's better. But basically, it's a Faustian bargain between Western economic pressure and select Iranian nuclear concessions. And this is supposed to go away in majority after about 5 to 10 years, but much of it is given up front. And this is supposed to scale back in for the first 5 to 10 years, and then it can ramp up after. So it's allegedly supposed to build trust in this 10-year period. Now, the Iranian desire for a weapon, in my view, has not changed. If you look at the regime's foreign and security policy, who would pay this immense cost for a program to generate less than 2% of your electricity? Clearly, there's an overwhelming, overarching strategic orientation for this program. And it wasn't about, in my view, the post-Soviet Ukrainian decision to give this away. Rather, I think the Islamic Republic looks at the North Korea example, contrast that in their view with the Iraq example. They have a bomb, they're still there. He didn't have a bomb, he's not there. And then already the suspicion and everything and the misperception and misinterpretations about the West put on top of the Libya example, which is the alleged trading away of the WMD in 2005, and then when the opportunity for a velvet revolution or whatever came around, kind of vindicated in the regime's worldview that they'll sell you out anyway. So their mistrust was already well baked in. Was it well earned? No, because I believe that they own the lion's share of the blame for their own situation, but ultimately this is their view.
Now, we've got a few people on the call, so I've got to be, Nyan, I'm going to go here, then we're going to go down there, then, hang on, we're going to go here, and then I've got one here, then we'll go there, and then I've got another one here. Okay, so we've got to be quick. All right.
Are the protests that you talked about an unrelated set of episodes, or are they the building of a movement? Could you also talk about corruption in the leadership and collapse of agriculture in Iran?
Very quick response.
I couldn't do the collapse of agriculture sufficient justice, mm-hmm. but with increased desertification and even drying up of many of the regime's lakes and a lot of needless dam building, because the major contractor is an Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps contractor, so it's more of a profit motive than a environmental or water management kind of motive for them. That kind of explains some of the poor environmental and agricultural issues. But to back end into the movement, yes, definitely 2017 to present represents a massive shift in the popular psyche of trying to reform the system towards outright overtly embracing revolution. And again, this can be seen through the slogans. This can be seen through protester demography, protester geography, the increased willingness of the protesters to go after taboo subjects, and the increased willingness of the state to use violence against the protesters. So that tells you there's a significant shift in the discourse. And that begins when you draw an end point with 2009, the failure of reform, and then from there on, and then starting in 2017 overtly to present, the outward coveting of revolution. So that is in many ways a gigantic shift. The open question is, what role will the capital play, which has the most in terms of the debt population density and number of people living there, what role will that play? And what role will exogenous shocks play, like the potential death of the supreme leader, potential conflict over the nuclear program, potential changes due to sanctions if there's a new nuclear deal? The exogenous shocks part is still the one that is least understood, but those are the shocks that we can pluck. The pattern of protests that respond to things like environmental, social, economic crises, those are the ones that are still hard to track. We just know the subject matter. We don't know what the potential incident would be.
Just a quick one from Terence Lovett on the Zoom. What's your assessment of the political and ethical wisdom of the Soleimani assassination and during the Trump administration by that drone? Just a quick response.
The political wisdom? I mean, ultimately...
And ethical wisdom, yeah.
I mean, the very interesting slash odd thing about the Soleimani killing is that there was a... You know, people should actually read UN documents sometimes. Had Soleimani listened to the UN resolution, the 2231 resolution that actually codified the nuclear deal, there was a travel ban against him. Had he actually listened to the marginal annexes of this UN resolution, he would be alive today. The thing is, Soleimani treated most of these Arab countries as if he had laissez-passer, this freedom of travel to move. And this is what in many ways in the past two decades has gotten this surge in Arab ire against Iran, because what Soleimani was doing was not sampling the fine cuisine of Iraq and Syria. What Soleimani was doing was creating those militia groups, doing things that basically set elements of society against each other, and treating Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Lebanon, countries that the regime in the past has called four Arab capitals, that the country that Tehran does control, as basically a battlefield for its strategic competition against Israel and its strategic competition against America. Now, I'm not going to relitigate the legal case for the killing of Soleimani, but I'll simply say that anyone who believes that there was a case for the removal of bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, from the battlefield due to the civilian casualties would know that there is one for Soleimani as well. But the difference is bin Laden didn't have the apparatus of a state behind him, and Soleimani did. So in my view, if this had, imagine this had happened earlier, would there be less IED and EFP attacks in Iraq if it happened in 2007? I'll give you a corollary to that. In 2007, that was not an arbitrary date. I just give that because that was the date in October 2007 that the branch of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps he commanded was sanctioned under counterterrorism authorities by Washington. But the entire Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps was not designated its entirety until 2017 or until 2019. So it took Washington a decade to even process, is this group a terrorist organization? One wondered if there would be a more productive use of Washington's time in that decade that could have avoided much bloodshed in the Middle East.
There's a question there. And I have one here, so we've got to move quickly.
Yes, thank you for your address. This is a short question. I think I'll give you a short answer.
I'll do my
speak
best.
Up a bit, will
you? The son of the deposed Shah, Reza, I think, established a project called the Phoenix Project of Iran back in February 2019 to call upon opposition, to marshal opposition. I'm just wondering how that's going. Has it made any traction, or is it defunct?
I don't know, and I was familiar with the launch of that entity, but I don't know, I haven't been following its updates. But something very interesting about him, for instance, many kind of are allergic to the Pahlavi name in Washington. I'm not particularly sure why. The most interesting thing is in this increasing 2017 to present period of nationalist protest, that's the only person's name that is actually chanted. His grandfather's name is chanted. His name is actually chanted. It's actually very interesting.
Traction, particularly the younger ones.
Yeah, but it's not a youth demographic thing. It's actually just, it's more of like a finger in the eye in the regime, and it's out of any opposition so far, this is my kind of non-empirical assessment of just reviewing protest slogans, videos, things on social media. It seems to be really the only opposition entity that is chanted by the people domestically inside Iran with the start of the 2017 to present nationalist protests. So I haven't seen any other opposition name chanted.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got to be very quick, and a quick response to this one. I'd like to ask, why are the 5+1 nations anxious to revive the nuclear deal despite professed opposition to an Iranian bomb?
Why are they
anxious to revive the deal despite their professed opposition to an Iranian bomb?
Well, you would have to break out part of the P5+1. So you have the Americans, the Europeans, and the Russians and the Chinese. The Russians and Chinese on the P5+1, to be very short, I promise, basically function as Iran's lawyers. They have mercantilist interests with the Islamic Republic, and empowering the Islamic Republic ultimately empowers them because it allows them to basically sic the Islamic Republic on America. the Americans. It's a complex, divided political question. I think now, unfortunately, the Iran deal has become a partisan issue. Republicans versus Democrats, the Obama legacy versus the Trump legacy, and it's likely going to be caught up in that. The Europeans are the most interesting to actually watch, because while the Americans and the Iranians have left the deal, the Europeans, in their view, believe that they have been the adults in the room throughout the process, and they remain at the table. They actually just recently tried to continue to try to get the two sides to talk again. It didn't work, but there is a troika of forces propelling European interest in this deal. Perhaps, maybe not a troika, but a quadrilateral of four forces. One is philosophy. Unlike the Biden administration, which has actually changed some of the Obama administration's goals, the Europeans believe that you can change the regime's behavior over time and with money. The Biden administration is not pursuing that line of thinking, even though the previous Democratic administration, the Obama administration, which got the deal, did espouse that you can kind of change their behavior over time and with money. So, number one, in terms of philosophy, they believe the deal would have still a moderating effect. Number two, politics, the politics of the EU. The JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, remains a key foreign policy achievement of the European Union and of the European Council. The European Council was pretty instrumental in many of the resolutions that contained some of the sanctions leading up to the deal. So bureaucratically, politically, structurally, it's a win that they don't want to dispense with. So for the legacy reasons, the political reasons, they want to keep it. Number three is the mercantilist reasons. For the business, the economic reasons. Again, the Europeans would stand to have significant trade if you have a deal that removes many of the Western economic impediments to business with Iran. And number four, this is where the dissonance is probably going to be the greatest. They continue to make the case for the counterproliferation merits of the deal, meaning that they believe the nuclear deal has good nuclear merits, whereas very interestingly, even the Biden administration is changing a little bit. On this point, they talk about not solving the Iran nuclear issue, but just merely capping it. Potentially given the high cost of gas right now, many are trying to look at a potential re-entry of an Iran nuclear deal, not as a nuclear-only deal, but as a potential oil or economic deal, because it would bring more Iranian oil on the market and thus help diminish cost given supply. I think these four reasons explain European attachment, and they're the four perhaps least understood, because we tend to look at the American and then the Russian and Chinese one, but these four, I think, are perhaps the most important.
So with a minute answer, you were here nearly 3 years ago. If you come back in 3 years' time, what do you think you'll tell us then?
Well, I would definitely have to brag about the fashion, but I think I would have more bad news. I think if we do another session in 3 years' time, I'd probably talk to you about increased Iranian long-range strike capabilities, which means more longer-range Iranian missiles, and hopefully I wouldn't be telling you about an Iranian nuclear bomb. I sincerely hope I wouldn't. On the longer-range strike stuff, absolutely. I think this is the direction the regime is moving in. They have a very robust, not just ballistic missile program, but space and satellite launch vehicle program. Which they're actually using to grow the range while allegedly having a 2,000-kilometer range cap. There's also something that they're doing in terms of its satellite and space launch vehicles. They're working more in terms of solid propellants, it's basically the fuel you need for these missiles rather than liquid propellants. Solid propellant rockets or missiles have motors. The liquid propellant ones have engines. Some of the engines for the liquid propellant ones are harder to use. Not going to bore you to death with these technical definitions, but there is greater military utility on this side of the aisle, the solid propellant systems, and the regime is trying to make bigger and bigger motors, bigger and bigger diameter, bigger and bigger weight, bigger and bigger size, generating greater thrust. This is going to have immediate military applications for the regime should it want to go down that program. So my fear is that you're going to have much, much more capable ballistic missiles, more capable than you have already, and you may have greater range. So I hope I'm disproven, but the trend lines are moving in that direction already.
Well, many thanks.
Thank you.
So thanks to Ben and Ben Talablu. Your paper here from 3 years ago holds up very well. It was realistic, it was pessimistic, but it was realistic. And I suspect your paper today is going to hold up well in 3 years' time, like you. I hope it doesn't, but I think it will. But you've been very generous to us tonight and given a very detailed analysis of the region, focusing on Iran, but not only on Iran. And we'd love to have you back. Many, many thanks and welcome.